If you've checked your mail in the last few weeks, you probably noticed an election mailer or two, maybe 10. Hi, I'm Manny Gomez, and this is Table Talk, a podcast about our hometown of La Mesa. Today, we're very excited to talk to our favorite candidate in the special election for County Board of Supervisors, Monica Montgomery Stepp. Thanks so much for joining us, Monica. How are you doing?
I'm doing wonderful. Thanks for doing this and for having me.
Sure. Glad to have you on and kind of give support in this race. Now, I don't think anyone starts off life saying, I want to be a politician when I grow up. Was there a moment that made you think this is something I need to do?
I really don't like the traditional, when we say politics and what that means or what we think that means. I really don't like the politics. I love the good governance part of it. And you kind of have to go through the politics to get to the governing aspect of it. So I say that to say, I graduated from Spelman College with a BA in political science. And, I love what I do, right? But I didn't say, oh, I want to be a politician in the worst sense of the word. I always really grew up service was really important to my family. And I was very attracted to government and the way that it works. And so it kind of all culminated to this point. But those are the things growing up, it was really about serving other people. And I don't know if that sounds cliche, but that really is how we grew up. And so this is just kind of, to me, another aspect of it.
Yeah. And I like that serving other people. That is, I think, to me, at least, and maybe for other people at large, that's something that politicians, quote unquote, forget at some point, or some of them forget that's why you're here is to serve your constituents and not, the people giving you money for your campaigns or, corporations and things like that. So that's glad to hear that you feel the same way. And really quickly, can you just give us a quick overview of your role within the San Diego City Council and some of your most important accomplishments?
Sure. So I am a city council member, one out of the 9 city council members that we have within the city of San Diego. I represent District 4, which is the community where I grew up. It's the southeastern part of San Diego. And I also on the council serve as the council president pro tem, which is really like a vice president. If the council president is gone or something like that, then I facilitate the meetings. So that's what that long, very long title really means. And on the city council, I've been very grateful to have accomplished a lot around police reform and reimagining public safety and what that looks like, how we define it, and what it feels like. I've also been able to drive over $100 million of investment into our communities in District 4, which have been traditionally under-resourced communities. And I say that, because I don't want it to ever be that the people that I serve are less than. It is not that at all. It's really the systems that have not given people across the board what they need. And, I serve some of the more under-resourced, historically underserved communities. And so we've worked a lot around affordable housing and try to make sure that people in San Diego that grew up in San Diego can stay here. We've done a lot around first-time home buyers programs as well. The accomplishments are ones that I'm pretty proud of and still ones that we haven't fully seen them come to fruition yet. Like we've advocated for a lot of budget funding and things like that. And I'm looking forward to seeing all of that, be manifested in the communities. But I do want to go back to police reform a bit, because I think folks have different definitions of this, right? So I have always supported police budgets. I've voted on 5 budgets so far. I serve as the chair of the Budget and Government Efficiency Committee at the city, and I have always supported police budgets. But I have really asked for accountability as well to go alongside those resources that we continually give the San Diego Police Department by way of the Independent Commission on Police Practices and also a surveillance ordinance that we passed as well that has a companion of a privacy advisory board. So, there is a lot out there. We'll probably get to that in this interview. and it kind of misrepresents and misleads people as to my reputation around community safety and public safety. But we've made a lot of accomplishments, and we can see the outcomes and results of the things that I've championed at the city.
Yeah, that's great. And we will get into some of the accountability things with the Sheriff's Department and police overall. But I wanted to kind of stay in line with the housing that you mentioned. So far, every candidate in the race has made addressing homelessness their top priority, and that makes sense. This year, the annual We All Count point in time count found that a 14% increase in people experiencing homelessness occurred in just 1 year. We'd like to hear how you approach addressing this issue and how that sets you apart from other candidates.
Well, I think I'll answer the last part of that question first, because from what I've heard, I think we've had about 10 different forums now. And, you know, the solutions that we're presenting around housing aren't that drastically different. I think what matters here is experience, because we have such a large bureaucracy in the city of San Diego and then in the county overall and its various cities, the unincorporated areas, and then also the state. So when we're talking about housing, you know, all of those entities kind of have to align. And it's not just who you know. It's really how you know the systems and how you can dive into the systems using your experience. That is, it can be very daunting. So I think that is the main difference. That is what really stands out. And that's what I'm asking voters to consider, because, you know, I would say all the people that are running this race are very smart people, but I'm the one that has the expertise as far as systems and bureaucracies are concerned. And so that really is going to make a difference as we see these numbers rising, because our systems haven't been built to handle this type of crisis and this type of emergency with urgency. And that's where I believe that I can drive that conversation and also encourage, you know, action more so than the other candidates. So that's one part of it. Solutions based, for me, it's all hands on deck. I think the only difference that I would say, I have mentioned, you know, leaving rent stabilization on the table, right? And creating a framework more so that we are looking at rents and possibly regulating rents, because it is really, really out of control. I don't have to tell anybody. I don't have to tell you that, if you know. And also people that are listening, I'm sure that they know as well. But the other solutions are providing, you know, rental subsidies. We did that at the city of San Diego through COVID and through the pandemic. We received hundreds of millions of dollars in federal funding. And I, you know, if we had not been able to spend that money the way that we were able to, I think we were one of the top cities in the nation to get the money out of the door quickly, then I think the problem would be a lot worse. And I also would say, I think the uptick has to do with the fact that some of those programs are no longer available because we're not getting that type of federal funding for those subsidies. So subsidies are extremely important as rents continue to rise. Also, within the point in time count, we see that the highest growing demographic is people 55 or older. So we do have our seniors out on the street in disproportionate numbers, which is, you know, that is then a moral issue too. So subsidies are important. Building is extremely important. Rent stabilization is very important. And these are things that I think I do have the expertise to kind of drive these types of solutions through the system with urgency.
Yeah. And I like that you tie morals into that discussion, because I think that's something that doesn't get brought up a lot is, you know, yeah, you know, you can build housing and make your money off of it, but what are you doing to provide for the community that you're building it? If you're right in and building luxury apartments that nobody can afford that are going to sit empty, then why are we allowing you to build in our communities? And, you know, to some extent, there's a requirement of 10% or 20% of the units available that have to be affordable, which who sets what affordable is. But why aren't we doing 100% affordable housing as opposed to the 10 or 20%? Why aren't we forcing these builders to comply with creating 100% affordable, sustainable buildings? And is there a way that you would potentially address that specific topic or issue as county supervisor?
Well, yeah, I think it's important to mention here that I have not been endorsed by the building industry because of some of the things that you bring up. I'm pro housing. I'm pro affordable housing. You know, most of the votes that I cast are tried to encourage and incentivize a building of affordable units, right? So that's not the issue. The issue is, you know, developers, many of them do great work in our communities, but you can't come in our communities and do whatever you want, right? Like there's the question that you bring up about the amount of affordable units. And I believe affordable units should be across the entire region, not just in concentrated areas, right? Because what we see oftentimes is a concentration of poverty, which is also not good. And HUD advises against that. So that's number one, that affordable housing be spread all across the region, right? But number two, people, once they enter housing, still need to be able to live, shop, work close to where they live. This is good for the environment, but it's also good for our communities. So what we don't want is folks coming in and building up a lot of units without providing additional amenities, you know, to the neighbors, additional park space, driving in retail, commercial, supporting our nonprofits, all of those things that make up full, healthy communities, they need to be a part of this conversation as well. And so you will find a lot of pushback when developers do say, hey, this does not pencil out. And sometimes that is the case, but the conversation, we have to continue to make it more broad, where we are providing for people places where they can afford to live, but also places where they can thrive. You know, I think that that is extremely important. And the last thing I'll say about this is, in direct answer to your question, is, you know, there is a question of who decides what is affordable. And that is a very circular, it goes in a circle, right? Like, we base development off of an average median income, right? And so when I say these housing units are going to be for people that make 30 to 60% of our average median income, well, our average median income in the region right now, I believe, is $110,000, right? For a family, I believe, of four. So affordable, technically speaking, from the definition, would be, you know, 30% of that. So 40 years ago, someone could buy a home making that much, right? Now it is extremely different. We have to keep that in mind as we continue to build, because you're absolutely right. Sometimes what we call affordable is not actually affordable, and it drives up that average median income across the board. So there's a lot of work to be done here, but we do need to build, because housing is very scarce.
It is. And I'm going to tie back into the homelessness issue for just a second. Here in La Mesa, we have the HOME program. They send people out into the community to talk to people experiencing homelessness and get to know them and try to help them find permanent housing and the services they need. We've actually had a decrease in unsheltered individuals from about 52 in 2020 to 36 in 2023. And we're just curious if this is something that could be used as a model at the county level.
Absolutely. And I'm really excited about testing and seeing what all of the cities are doing, and to look at the best practices even that we have within the county and the various municipalities, and see what, you know, what actually works. The most exciting thing for me about the possibility of becoming a supervisor is that there is an infrastructure for health and human services. That's the largest part of the budget. There's the infrastructure for funding around behavioral health services and mental health services, and tying that into getting people where they need with housing and providing those wraparound services is what I'm really excited about, because the cities are doing this work without that type of infrastructure and are still showing some success and some promising outcomes. And so I'm really, really looking forward to that. it's sort of related, but want to just throw this as another successful program in that we started at the city. This is it. Actually, we're working with our San Diego Police Department to reduce violence and in particular, gang violence in our city. And I bring this up in the context of providing these additional wraparound services and possibly housing and other job training, other things that people need, is because that is also a part of this program called No Shots Fired. And we've seen a decrease in gang homicide across the city, over 65% in the last year. These are the types of programs that really focus holistically on what a person may need and not just kind of do a traditional way of outreach or even a way of arresting folks. But if they need help, help should be available to them.
Now, could you expand a little bit on the No Shots Fired program for people that aren't specifically familiar with that, to give them a little bit of background and what that focuses on?
Sure. So when I came into office, the year after I came into office, there were 4 shootings in one night across the district. And at this time, there was also a lot of other gun violence going on across the city too. We had definitely seen an uptick. And I, you know, again, said we have funded the police department budget and increases year over year, right? So I had done some research, and also my capacity at the ACLU and some of my community partners, around other ways that we could try to reduce violence. So we have community partners that came up with No Shots Fired. It really is a program that includes violence interrupters. So if a shooting or an incident occurs, they go out. They partner with the police department. They go out to the scene, or sometimes go to the families that have experienced loss or may be potentially experiencing loss. They also go out to the hospitals, and they do this to let the families know that they have a resource and also to prevent any type of retaliation. And so this program is funded through our city's budget. It's funded at the tune of $250,000 per fiscal year. And we've already seen some of the results. It's a very, very important partnership. But again, it just goes back to building out that holistic public safety ecosystem. How do we meet people where they are at in order to actually reduce violence and prevent it from happening in the first place? That's a very important part of this equation that I think we have to do more work around.
Yes, I would agree. And, you know, it is important to be proactive and kind of get ahead of issues before they turn into issues, and have those types of resources available. And the mobile crisis response teams have really been a game changer in our county. Now anyone in crisis can call 888-724-7240. And rather than getting a response from armed police officers, they'll receive support from a team of specialists who knows how to deal with mental health, drug, and alcohol-related issues. Now, specifically related to those issues, mental health, drug, and alcohol abuse, how and what are your plans for addressing these specific issues in our county?
Well, definitely expanding what was the pilot program for the mobile crisis response units. I think that's extremely important. We have to increase the number of beds that we have for people who are experiencing or need behavioral health or mental health services. But in addition to that, I chair a regional board, the San Diego Workforce Partnership Policy Board. And we did a study last year that told us about some of the struggles of behavioral health service providers and workers, and that in order to really accomplish some of these goals that we need when we're talking about expanding these programs and having more beds and making sure that people have emergency housing, emergency treatment, we have to, over the next 5 years, be able to hire over 18,000 people. And so in the study, it goes into depth, but the quotes and the stories of the people who are in the industry right now are some of the most telling quotes and some of the most heartbreaking, because people want to be in this industry. They want to help folks in their time of need, but they just are not making enough money to be able to do that and live in San Diego without being completely stressed out and bringing that stress also to the workplace. And they're experiencing burnout because of all of the things the pandemic exacerbated, right? So we really have to concentrate on building out this industry and, you know, maybe providing incentives like paying off, you know, a portion of student loans for people, or of course wage increases, those types of things. So as we add more to the system, more beds, more services, we have to make sure that we are taking care of and recruiting and retaining the people that serve in this way. I think that that is, you know, extremely, extremely important. I am so interested and ready to really get into the weeds with the hospitals and find out how we can have more connectivity there, especially with housing services, because we are finding that there is patient dumping, right? People are being left outside of the hospitals, right, without the proper resourcing. So there are a lot of gaps that we need to fill. And I think it's really important that we get the full picture of homelessness. And I think we're all still doing that every day as it evolves, right? But we have to recognize that most of the people who are homeless and or unsheltered have had an economic crisis to get them where they are, right? That economic crisis may turn into mental health issues, of course, physical health issues, addiction. It may definitely turn into that. But many, many people are living day by day right now, whether we see them on the street or not, because they cannot afford to live here. And so kind of level setting that is extremely important. Now, but second to that, a close second to that, is the fact that we do not have the vast number of resources that people need. And we have to build on those with urgency.
Yes, yes. And I think that, you know, it's easy enough to say, what are you going to do as county supervisor to address these issues without kind of tying that back into these individual communities that are experiencing them on a smaller level? So how can council members and community leaders within San Diego County help in addressing the need for mental health and substance abuse facilities and resources within those communities?
Oh, wow. That's a good question. And I am a council member currently. So really going in and understanding the jurisdictional issues or matters between, you know, the county, the chartered cities, incorporated cities, and unincorporated areas is very important. We all have to make some hard choices, and we all have to make some sacrifices. I talked a little bit earlier about affordable housing being not just in one particular area, right? But in, you know, many different areas that, of course, you know, keeping in mind the climate action plan and the goals that we have to make around climate action, of course. But this is a very important issue, that we do spread this type of housing across the region. And I bring that up in this context because there is quite a bit of resistance, sometimes understandably so, right? I think we need to talk through these issues a little bit more, because oftentimes we begin to judge each other. We label each other like, I don't want that in my backyard. And another person says, yes, I want it in my backyard, you know? And I think we have to continue to talk to each other and talk through these issues, because sometimes you really can get support from neighbors if they understand the process, they understand what's going to be in their communities. We have to build out additional facilities. Neighbors need to have a say in those things, you know, but we also have to be realistic. We all are going to see some changes, and I think we all have to wrap our heads around how we will work together, reduce homelessness together, and care for our neighborhoods still. And so it's very complicated, but I work through those issues every single day, and I'm, you know, looking forward to engaging the various city council members across the region in my role as supervisor.
Yeah, and I like that you bring that up, is the resistance to some of these programs. And people do, they are very, you know, vocal about how, you know, these are definite issues that need to be taken care of, but then they also forget that they're part of their community and they have to accept that these things will be located in their community. We will have these people in our community who need help, and it has to happen somewhere, and we all have to get on board. So I'm very happy to hear that you are willing to go around to these different communities and kind of have this conversation, whether it's just with the council or potentially a town hall or something where people can engage and ask questions and have somebody tell them, you know, yes, this is something we're going to address. This is how we're going to do it. And I'm going to need your help doing it. If you can get people to realize that they're part of the solution, that will help change their mind and get them on board with things that they may otherwise be reluctant to support. Now, going back to what we were talking about earlier regarding the police department and the sheriff, in May of 2020, La Mesa experienced what was arguably the most traumatic incident in our city's history, a peaceful protest that turned into a riot. That night, La Mesa PD relinquished command to Sheriff's Department, which sent out 170 deputies. Our community had a lot of serious questions for the Sheriff's Department, but when the city launched an official inquiry into that night, the Sheriff's Department refused to provide a single in-person interview, despite several requests from investigators and La Mesa Police Department. Talk about what you can do to bring accountability to the Sheriff's Department.
Yeah, you know, with the Sheriff's Department right now, where we stand right now, many of the complaints that we hear are based on a lack of information and communication. And, you know, some of it is, yes, there are certain aspects of the Sheriff's Department that are probably stretched a bit thin. But I do believe that communication is extremely important. You know, when we're talking about what La Mesa did experience, and of course, how can any of us forget that? If we did not live there, we certainly were watching it and trying to support in whatever way we could. But there has to be that type of transparency that our law enforcement agencies run to, and, you know, and not run away from, because there's a lot of authority in a badge and a gun. And that authority has to be balanced out with the level of accountability that is appropriate. And I really have been doing that work and trying to strike that balance for majority of my career, even outside of being a city council member, because it really, really is all about trust. And if there is no trust, it's hard to serve people when they don't trust you. It's important. This is one of the other issues that has to be in the light. We have to shine a light on it. We have to continue to include community in these conversations, but we have to have strong accountability measures. And when something is not right, then it has to change. And that is, it's a tough topic, but I'm here for it, because I think it's so, so important. Everyone wants to feel protected and served. And I think we find disparities in how that is played out in our communities. And so my ask is that everyone be fair, be transparent, be upfront in the way that you are doing your job, and you will have less, you'll have less issues with the public. So
yeah, transparency is the key word there, I think. And we could use a lot more of that from the Sheriff's Department in a lot of different regards. So I wanted to kind of move away from that for just a second and give you a chance to respond to some claims that have been made about you. Everyone I talked to in La Mesa has received a stack of mailers saying that homicides skyrocketed under your leadership and that you support defunding the police. La Prensa investigated that claim and described them as misleading hits. But we'd like to hear your response regarding that.
Yeah, they are misleading. And like I said in the beginning, I have voted for every police budget for 5 years. They have always included an increase. I think overtime, just overtime in this last budget cycle, was right up at $50 million. I have supported a home buyer program for police officers, retention funding for police officers, lateral bonuses. And so, you know, all I can think of is that I dare to hold the police department accountable. So then this is, you know, sort of the punishment for that. It's very misleading. They're really outright lies. And it is more than unfortunate that the Police Officers Association and the Deputy DA's organization called San Diegans Against Crime have decided to go this route. This is politics. And in the very beginning, I talked about, I like the governing. I don't like the politics. You know, I don't like the politics because people that we're supposed to trust and supposed to serve all of us put out mailers with completely misleading information. You know, it's just not right. And I think that's, I don't know if they're upset at the success of the program. I was excited about working, being able to, you know, try to build that community trust and working with the police on some of the programming that we have, you know. And so it's disappointing to see them go that route. And just a couple other things. I mean, they have no jurisdiction in the county, the Police Officers Association. Why are they getting involved? And then two, you know, this the graphics and the way that the placement and the darkening on these mailers, it's really kind of feeding into a lot of the racist tropes that they said they don't feed into when it comes to racial profiling. And that's where I have another issue that hasn't been talked about as much, but they really are racist attacks. So not only are they misleading in the content, but, you know, in the way that they have designed them, it's just really, it's unfortunate, but it proves my point. You know, it proves my point that, you know, if you dare to hold these folks accountable, then this is how they go. So I just want to tell everybody in La Mesa that's listening that the content of these mailers is misleading. La Prensa did do a good job, I think, their own research of laying it out, because I had no idea where that 400% number came from. I really just didn't know how they had calculated that. And I've always been very transparent about the state of my communities and what I did to try to change that around. So it happens. It's very unfortunate. I am hoping that, you know, people can kind of see through it and they have enough information out there that they can make an informed decision. But yes, those mailers are untrue. And it's very unfortunate that people that really are, we depend on them to be trustworthy and honest, are sending out misleading information like that.
To me, that says more about you being a staunch advocate for rights and them going after you because they are, quite frankly, afraid of what you're potentially going to do once you get into this position. Yeah. which is frankly why we want you there. So it's more telling on what you're potentially going to do than anything else. So I wanted to go on to one more quick thing here before we end. Here at Table Talk, we believe that participating in democracy is more than just turning in a ballot every election. It's about showing up, participating, and getting involved in campaigns. So I just want to ask how people could help get involved in your campaign.
Yeah, thank you for the question. So you can go to the website and sign up. So it's www.monica4sandiego.com. That's Monica4sandiego.com. We have a place where you can sign up if you want a yard sign, if you want to make some calls and a phone bank. You can come to some of our different locations where we'll be at. We'll let you know where we are, but you can also do it from home and maybe Zoom on with us and make the calls from home. You can also walk if you still like door knocking and go door to door and talk to people, and you can also text. So there are a lot of things. We have 15 days to do all of this, and we still have a lot of voters that we would like to reach. We really are looking for turnout more than what the political pundits are expecting. We're hoping that people really, really turn out for this race. If we turn out, we're going to do this, you know, and that's so important. So this, at this stage, it's about voter contact, voter outreach, making sure that people are filling out that ballot, putting it in the mail or in a drop box or taking it up to the registrar of voters by August 15th. But don't wait. Don't sit on your ballot. Turn it in right away. And then call us. Also, the number is 619-796-4046. You can call there or text there and let us know you want to volunteer. We'll get the schedule to you.
Perfect. Yeah, I know a lot of people and almost everyone I've talked to about this race, and they're very excited about having you in it and getting you elected. So look forward to getting that done. And I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today, Monica. That's it for this episode. Andy Trimble and Josh Crimston produced this podcast, and a big thanks to Jordan Crimston for composing our theme song. Thanks for listening to Table Talk.